morning and welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yada. It's time for us to turn the page and consider what Yahweh had to say. For those who have been listening, you know that we have dedicated several months of programming to try to understand the conditions that God created in the Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden, the protective enclosure that is conducive to life, that was holy and completely satisfying and full of all forms of joy. And we have chronicled everything from the uniqueness of the first Homo sapien with a nesama, which was a conscience. That's the one thing that made Adam different than the Homo sapiens outside of the garden. We listened to God's initial dialogue with Adam so that we knew what kind of relationship God was seeking to conceive with us. And over time, we have turned to God allowing Satan in the form of the serpent. That's a metaphor. He didn't come in looking like a snake into the garden. And we have been analyzing the technique that was used to beguile Chawa and Adam. And in that discussion, one of the things we learned is that those who would proclaim that their Bible, which is not a name that God would ever use because it's the name of a pagan sun goddess, is perfect and inerrant, that God would never allow anyone to corrupt his word is utter nonsense. The first story about God's word is that it was corrupted. God allowed it. God made the decision to allow the adversary to come into the garden, open the gates, allowed him in, and allowed him to twist his testimony and allowed Chawa to both subtract from it and add to it. If you listen to what she had to say, she removed the name of the tree that was in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so that she did not, was by removing it, by subtracting from God's testimony, she no longer understood what the reason was for the instruction regarding the tree. God didn't just say, don't do something unless there's a reason. And he takes the time to explain the reason. Well, she eliminated the reason. And then she added to what God said, which is like the Christian New Testament, which is added to what God said, to create an entirely different conclusion. You should not even touch it. And so based upon that, her twisting the God's testimony, taking it out of context, she, Hasatan, then gave a false impression that if she ate of it, then she would be like God. Well, the fact is, she was already like God. God created humankind in his image. We are merely a shadow of what God is like. It's like Walt Disney creating Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse is a two-dimensional representation of its creator, a three-dimensional construct. And the difference between being 3.5 dimensions, which is what we humans are. We're a three-dimensional construct stuck in the ordinary flow of time. And God, who's 7 dimensions, is significant. But we're still in his image. So there was nothing that Chawa was going to gain, but she was going to lose something, and that was her innocence. And the way that you lose your innocence is you become associated with that which is counterproductive, evil. And that's why it was the tree of good and bad. She, for the first time, was going to have the access to bad. Now, you might wonder why even God would allow that inside the garden. Why not just make everything in the garden good? Well, if that is the case, then there is no choice. Then Adam and Chawa are no longer thinking individuals. They're no longer engaged in a relationship because they've chosen to. They're there because there's no other option. Under that basis, what would the benefit be for God? What would he get out of it? Nothing. So free will was essential. So there had to be that answer. We then spent several programs talking about God approaching Adam and him providing the solution. We learned that, if you disregard, add to, subtract from, or just disregard God's guidance regarding his covenant relationship, the consequence is separation. And God then provided the remedy back, which from Kara, which is based upon his 7 mikra, this invitation to meet with him that resolves that dispute. And that's the first comment he made to Adam. Now, Adam's response when God said, not only where are you, but why did you do this? you'll, you know, who told you thought you were, you're naked all of a sudden, is that it demonstrates that the actual God, the God who authored the Torah, who created the universe, there are many things that he does not know, things he does not want to know. It would be excruciatingly painful for God to know all of those people who are promoting religious myths and leading people away from him. A lot of disgusting things we humans do. There's no reason for God to expose himself to that kind of malfeasance. So God does not hear the prayers of religious individuals. He doesn't engage in their lives. He finds that all repulsive. He engages in the lives of those who choose to know him and who choose to participate in his covenant. At this point, Adam and Chawa had chosen the opposite, to disregard his instructions and to disassociate themselves from the covenant. So he had to say, you know, where are you, Adam? Who told you you were naked? Why are you in this predicament? And so Adam tried to deflect. It's something we humans have done for a long time. Adam said, the woman you gave me to be with, she gave it to me from the tree and I ate. In other words, hey, God, it's your fault. You gave me this woman, and she is the one that that gave this to me to eat. Therefore, you want to blame somebody, blame yourself. You know, we humans have this tendency to want to blame God for everything that goes awry in our lives as opposed to take personal responsibility. God told him, don't eat from that tree. Eat from the tree, there's going to be consequence. And, you know, your choice. I'm going to give you the option, but don't do it unless you're willing to endure the consequence. And here's the man saying, no, 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 not my fault, your fault. You gave me this woman, she told me to eat, and so I did. Yahweh then turned to Chawa and he said to the woman, why did you do this? The woman said, the serpent deceived and deluded me, and I ate. What's really interesting is that the serpent was only, this Hasatan, the adversary, was only modestly involved in deceiving her. The first thing that that Chawa did is deceive herself. As I said, she subtracted from God's instructions, added to them. And when you subtract from the Torah and add to it, you can very easily end up with a message that is inconsistent with God's instructions. She did it to herself. But that really is how most religions work. Christians are all too eager to give Satan credit or blame when they did it themselves. You know, yes, Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, admitted in his letter to the Corinthians that he was demon-possessed. Yes, he was inspired by Hasatan. But much of what he wrote was his own personal crusade against God. And so we really have no one to blame but ourselves for the hellish religions that we have perpetrated on the world. So the woman said, you know, she's going to deflect attention. Adam blamed God and blamed the woman, not himself. And the woman says, no. You were the one that allowed this this silly old serpent to come in here, and the serpent beguiled me. Now, we talked yesterday about the idea of you know, when you finally meet God and you and he says, you know, why didn't you pay any attention to my Torah? You know, in my Torah I said, I want this covenant relationship with you. It's a family-oriented relationship. I just want to be dad. But, you know, I don't want eternity in my home to be like the mess that you've got down there on earth. So, you know, I've got five conditions for participating in the covenant. The first is you have to walk away from religion and politics. The second is I want you to rely on me instead of relying on your military or economic solution or whatever it may be in terms of politics or religion. And third, walk to me along the path that I have provided and become perfect. Observe the instructions that I have provided so that you understand what I'm offering and so you can make a rational decision. And then I'd like you to raise your children so that your sons become members of my family and so circumcise them. Those are the five conditions. And what God is revealing to us that if we ignore those conditions, then we're estranged from his covenant. No. But it's not to say that to be estranged from his covenant, which is, you know, the Christian's going to say, wait a minute, but my pastor lied to me. You know, but my mom and dad told me that this was the right way to go and sent me to church. It's not my fault. What you're going to find is that God doesn't buy that excuse. This idea that ignorance is bliss, or that the victim has an excuse because they were misled, God says no. You know, you were given the opportunity to listen to his instructions. If you choose to ignore them or reject them or despise them, as most Christians do with the Torah, then it's your choice. And God's not going to say, you know, I'm going to overlook the fact that you ignored my guidance. And that's what we're going to find out happens next. There is some interesting terminology in this statement. First of all, God is asking a question. There is this myth in religion that God is all-knowing. God is all-present, he's all-powerful, he's all-knowing. Not true. It's just not true. If God was omnipresent, then he would be indistinguishable from his creation, rendering him meaningless. So he's not. God also can't be all-knowing, because if he was all-knowing, he wouldn't ask questions like this. And if he was all-knowing, then his creation would be vastly too painful to endure. And if he was all-knowing, there could be no means to salvation, because part of his process for salvation has him no longer remember the things that we have done that are aggravating. So he asked a genuine question. Why'd you do it? And the woman said, and Ilah, of course, is the term that is applied to the woman. It's the term that God uses for the feminine manifestation of his light in the path back home. And she said, the serpent, the Nahas, the poisonous reptile, the cold-blooded and venomous snake, all symbolic terms here, deceived and deluded me. This was Nasa, and I ate and I consumed it. You know, religion, and this is an important distinction. Being in proximity to religion is not a problem from God's point of view. But it's safer to distance yourself from it. The fact is that it's when we consume that which is poisonous for us that it affects us. And so here it is that Hasatan encouraged Chawa to consume it. She was now poisoned with evil. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the interesting things in this particular statement, Yahweh Almighty said to the woman, why did you do this? And the woman said, the serpent, the poisonous viper, deceived and deluded me, Nasa. And I ate. Nasa and Nasha are written identically in the original text of Bereshith Genesis. They are pointed differently in the Masoretic. In the Masoretic, the only difference between a shin and a sin, as a Hebrew letter, is whether a diacritical mark is put up on the right side of something. It looks like a W. On the right side of the W or the left side of the W. The leading edge or the successive edge. And it's whether it is Nasa or Nasha is determined by that. In the original text, there was no such distinction. And so the reason this is important is that the Nasa means to lift up. It is to, in a context like this, it could be to promote, to advance, to tolerate, to accept, to lift up. Nasha means to deceive and to delude. Now, in this particular case, it obviously has to be Nasha to deceive and delude. The woman wouldn't have said, the serpent lifted up and tolerated, and I ate. The serpent lifted up and raised up, and I ate. No, it's got to be deceived and deluded. Now, why that's important is this is the first use of this word Nasa or Nasha, depending on how it is subsequently pointed by the Masoretes. And that is of issue because It is the dominant word in what is considered by most to be the third commandment. It's actually the third statement that Yah etched on the first of the two tablets of stone. And so if it is Nashah, it's God is saying, don't deceive. If it's Nashah, it's don't lift up and promote. And in the case of his instruction, he speaks of show, which is lifelessness and destruction. So don't lift up and advance lifelessness and destruction in my name. But if it's Nashah, it's don't deceive in association with God's name or on behalf of lifelessness and death. And so here's the statement with Nashah rendered both ways. Don't promote and don't deceive in association with your God's name on behalf of a lifeless and ruinous, empty falsehood. Because indeed, Yahweh will not pardon those who lift up in advance, Nashah, who promote or tolerate, even respect, that which is lifeless and destructive in association with his name. So here we are being given a glimpse into God's use of the word. And I think in the third instruction, it's vastly more insightful when Nashah is used to say, don't deceive in the name of God, because God's not going to forgive those who deliberately deceive, causing people to needlessly die. Now, of course, if you're reading your English Bible, the one that your pastor has told you is inerrant, it will say, do not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And yet, show doesn't mean vain. When vain is either failed or egotistical. You can't take a name. There's no way to associate a name with failed or egotistical. And Nashah does not mean take. And Yahweh used his name. Lord is Satan's title. So if you're reading your English Bible, it isn't even close. But in terms of the actual words that God chose, he most often communicates his message to us in such a way that he defines the terms that he uses. When the terms are important, he defines them in his first use of the word. That's what we have here. Now, if we move on and we consider what was God's response. So he begins by asking questions. It's something that he encourages us to do. It's the sad thing about those embroiled in propagandistic religious or political controversies, they very seldom ask questions. You don't see those who gather in churches or mosques asking questions. But that's God's approach. If you want to learn, you ask questions. If you want to know, you ask questions. You seek answers. That was God's approach. It has not been man's approach, but it is the approach we ought to take. Now, when we return to Shattering Myths, we're going to move on to God's commentary. He's going to begin with the serpent, move on to the man, and then the woman. So here's Yahweh's response. This notion that God is eager to forgive everyone is untrue. There are consequences, and sometimes there's even a penalty associated with doing that which is inappropriate. Yahweh Almighty said to the serpent, now he's speaking to HaSatan, the adversary. Now, mind you, the adversary has a purpose. God created him. God allowed him into the garden in the first place. So his purpose is to make the choice to not embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, not come to know God, credible enough that people are willing to turn away from him. So, Yahweh Almighty said to the serpent, because you have done this, you have brought a curse upon yourself. Now, curse is now a penalty. There's consequences and penalties. A consequence for being victimized by religion is that you die. God does not say that if you choose not to to know him and accept the terms and conditions of his covenant that he's going to torture you in hell forever. If he had said such a thing, he would be sadistic. That's the reason that most thinking agnostics are agnostics, is they recognize that the Christian position, where it's either heaven or hell, would turn God into a sadist. Completely unlovable. Well, God doesn't say that. There are those who will be punished. But to endure eternal separation from God, you have to be actively engaged leading others away from God, which was precisely what HaSatan, the adversary, was attempting to do. So Yahweh said to the serpent, because you have done this, what did he do? He misrepresented God's testimony, encouraged man, in particular this case, Chawa, to add to and subtract from his testimony, and then came up with a conclusion that was misleading. Because you have done this, you brought a curse upon yourself. You invoked injury, misfortune, harm, more than any class of living being. HaSatan is a life form, a different kind of life form than we are, in the sense that we are corporeal. We have physical bodies. Being corporeal has advantages and disadvantages. But the primary advantage of being a spiritual being, which is what HaSatan is that you are infinite in time. You cannot die. Even God can't kill a spiritual being. And as a spiritual being, you have much more flexibility as it relates to time. It is our physical nature that causes us to be stuck in the ordinary flow of time. So he has a lot more time, if you will, to perpetrate malfeasance. So because you have done this, you have brought a curse upon yourself more than any other class of living being, more than any form of life. So God has twice now used terms to let us know that the adversary is real, that it is a life form, that the malak, which are the terms that he uses, not angels, the malak, which is the Hebrew word for messenger and envoy, his spiritual messengers and envoys are a life form. About two-thirds of them still serve Yahweh. They're in a command and control construct, which means they do not have free will. And one-third serve to lead people away from God, and they're associated with HaSatan. But they are alive. In fact, they are the epitome of life because they are eternally alive. He says that you are worse than any other class of animal, any form of life, of consciousness in the realm, which is, the realm is Sade, which is the open environs outside of the walled enclosure. God is saying that there is life outside of the garden. Dying, deceit, trickery, all those kinds of things existed outside of the garden. The garden was just simply an enclosure for all of the joys and positive aspects of life, keeping death and sorrow and pain at bay. So God says, on your belly, as the part of the reptile that makes contact with the ground, you shall move about, you shall travel and proceed, and the dirt, the minute elements and particles which comprise matter, you shall eat all of the days of your life. So HaSatan is going to be reduced in stature. So man was designed as a unique creature so that we could stand. God does not want us bowing down. He hates the idea of us worshiping him. He does not want us on our knees. He wants us standing up. We were designed to stand so we could walk with God. We could be friends, buddies, co-explorers, if you will. But those who choose to disregard God's offer of the covenant, then their stature is reduced, whether to be on their knees or on their belly. The stature is reduced. They end up with the opposite of what God intended for us, which is to stand with him, to be on our feet, to be friends, sons and daughters with their father, as opposed to being diminished in this way. And the minute elements, the particles of the dirt, the afar that he will consume, is symbolic of the only ultimate consequence or penalty that can be afforded to a spiritual entity. God cannot kill spirits. And so for there to be a consequence or penalty for what Hasatan did, he has to be diminished. And what we find is that Sheol, which is the place of separation from God that's created for those who are overtly religious and political, as well as for Hasatan and his fellow demons, is that it is in essence a black hole where physical matter is diminished, and it's an eternal place that is lightless, but is inescapable, with enormous pressures that diminish everything to a minuscule percentage of what it once was. That is precisely what God is saying is going to happen here. And it even says lives, recognizing that Hasatan is going to endure forever. So for there to be justice, there must be recompense. For a judge to be moral, he must or she must punish those who deceive, destroy, steal and kill. Satan used half-truths, a corruption, and a straw man to delude Chawa, destroying her relationship with Yahweh, robbing her of her home, and ultimately misdirecting her soul. For that, Satan will be punished. God's sentence, however, was not death. And the reason is that spirits, unlike souls, are immortal. Even God cannot kill them. So that is why the misfortunate adversary, the adversary brought on himself. His retribution will be eternal anguish. Now, this anguish is not God torturing. This is not Islam, where Allah spends all of his time torturing peaceful Muslims and infidels in hell. God has no access to hell. He can put souls there, but it's the place of separation from him, and so by definition is the place that he cannot go. The only anguish that exists in Sheol is that the immortal know that they can never escape, and they know that forever that they had the opportunity to have a relationship with God but chose not to. So Satan will be incarcerated for all but the last fleeting moments of the millennial sukkah, or Shabbat, that is 20 years on our horizon. He will be released in its waning days and will use similar tactics to deprive many of those born during this 1,000-year celebration of camping out with God, where the earth is returned to the conditions of the Garden of Eden, causing many others to be on the wrong side of the covenant. This will be the final rebellion, and then Satan and his fellow demons, as well as those who leagued with him, will be tested and will be found to be wanting. They will be tested in what's called the lake of fire, passing through judgment, and they'll find themselves in the eternal prison of Sheol. So, spiritually, the spirit of deceit was cast down, and as a result will spend his days devouring much of humankind. Adam was created from the very substance Satan was now predicted to be consuming. Scientifically, and the leading astrophysicist of our day, Stephen Hawking, has invested the last decade of his life in the advancement of the theory, which is suggested here, that matter can be consumed. He has postulated that a condition exists within the confines of black holes that make this possible. While most scientists dispute his conclusions, knowing that physics itself is based upon the conservation of matter, Hawking is merely reporting what Yahweh has revealed. The first thing God said he will do following the millennial Shabbat is to completely destroy the entire universe. But don't be alarmed. He is going to instantaneously create a new one, but this time with us as witnesses, in addition to being its beneficiaries. The prophetic portrayal, follows, really applies to the overall relationship between Hasatan, the adversary, and mankind, especially as it is manifest in the role that politics have played in beguiling and suppressing people. But it is especially poignant when seen from the perspective of the chosen people. As you listen to these words, think about how Hasatan's religions, Christianity, Islam, socialist, secular, humanism, have targeted Jews as their principal enemy. No population on earth has been treated with more rancor for longer than God's eyewitnesses. Here's the statement. It's from Bereshit, Genesis 3:15. Hostility and animosity, enmity, a deep-seated dislike and rancor, will be constituted and established. Sheath will be placed between you, this is now he's speaking to Satan, and the woman, and between your seed, your species, if you will, your offspring, those who are demon-possessed, and her offspring. He shall crush your head, and you shall press down upon his heel. So, what God is saying here is that the seed of woman and Hasatan will be in conflict with one another. Now, part of this is prophetic because the seed of woman is ultimately speaking of the rise of Yahusha. But it is also speaking of the rise of the children of Yisrael, with whom Yahweh revealed his Torah, his prophets, and his Psalms. And it's particularly invocative of them when it has Hasatan pressing down upon his heel, because Jacob means heel. Jacob is the one who was renamed Yisrael. He is the father of the 12 tribes of the chosen people. So here's Yahweh predicting and also describing the consequence of Hasatan's behavior, saying that there's going to be enmity, hostility, animosity established between Hasatan, the adversary, and the woman. And between your offspring, he's speaking of Satan, and Chawa's offspring, between the offspring of the adversary. The offspring of the adversary is our religious and political leaders, those that are inspired by ideas that separate us from God. And that God is then saying that ultimately the seed of woman will crush Satan's head, his source. And that's what Yahusha did by fulfilling the Mikra promises. And that Hasatan would focus on pressing down on man's heel. And you wouldn't have any idea what Akeb would be if you didn't know that Akeb was the basis of Jacob. And that Jacob speaks of one who firmly supplants his heels as he walks so as to be steadfast in his walk with God. And it was Jacob who was renamed by God Yisrael. He is the father of the 12 tribes. And so here God is predicting that, that the most effective way that Satan will choose to beguile humankind is by nipping at the chosen people's heels. Now, spirits cannot reproduce. So Satan doesn't have offspring in the sense of sons or daughters. But several places throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and most vividly in Yahusha's rant also against the Jewish religious and political establishment in Matanyah, Matthew 23, Satan's little helpers are called the seeds of serpents. So God is specifically amplifying, explaining this text in his attack on religion and politics, as it's recorded by the disciple Matanyah, calling the politicians and the religious leaders in Israel at the time the seed of serpents. So just as it is possible and desirable to be born anew from above and Yahweh set apart spirit, it is possible to be born from below spiritually. When a mortal soul leagues with Satan, they become like him, immortal, and thus to the same eternal punishment. That's why when Paul professed to having been demon-possessed, you know for certain where he is spending his eternity. One way to distinguish these people and thus avoid them is that men and women who conspire with Satan often deploy the same tactic that the adversary used in the garden. Humans throughout history and in every realm have been crushed and bruised and pressed down by an unholy alliance, a marriage, if you will, of cleric and king, using half-truths, using straw men, and using corruptions and counterfeits of God's word. Very seldom will you see any political or religious scheme that doesn't at least begin by expropriating a kernel of truth from something that God revealed to us in his Torah, but then they'll twist it, take it out of context, add to it, subtract from it, for it to become a counterfeit, and thus wholly worthless. The seed of woman who pushes Satan and his minions down, who crushes them at their source, is Yahusha. Yahweh diminished himself to human form to voluntarily accept the consequence of our sin, our rebellion against him, freeing us from the punishment, therefore, by foiling Satan's agenda. And as I mentioned, the Akeb reference is to Jacob. So God is letting us know how religious and political schemes would turn against Yisrael, and have they ever. You know, you look at Christianity and how anti-Semitic it has been for all of these years. When it was born by Constantine, Constantine's heralds would specifically say that anything that was that Yahweh instructed Yisrael to do was now punishable by death, putting the religion of Christianity directly at odds with God's chosen people. And you look at Islam, where Allah, who is modeled after Satan, literally becomes ruthlessly anti-Semitic, saying in the Quran that he turned Jewish faces into their posteriors, that he made it certain that all Israelites, Jews, would become monkeys and swine, and then tells good Muslims to kill them for extra rewards in Allah's brothel. We'll return to Shattering Myths at this time tomorrow. Between now and then, may Yah bless.